1340 KVOT, the voice of Taos. We are back, and this is a supremely huge day for me, as the Supreme Court will come down with their decision tomorrow regarding gay marriage, and in my words, the last huge civil rights movement in the United States. And what will they decide? They haven't been very friendly today as they overturned the voter laws, the laws having to do with schools. And how will they come down? It's difficult to know. 8 a.m. tomorrow, huge gathering at DMC Broadcasting. Win or lose, regrouping or popping the corks. We invite you to be here at our studios. Lenny Foster will be taking a group shot of our supporters and everybody, but then a special one of anyone who identifies with the LGBTQ community. Lesbian, gay, transgendered, queer community. You come on by and we will have a photo shoot so we can say Taos represents. Fabi Romero is in our studio, and thanks to Sylvia Rodriguez, who put this together for us, a regular guest, anthropologist emeritus from University of New Mexico. Fabi, I've known you for 33 years, and you're a treasure, and I and a shit disturber, and good, well-behaved women rarely get things done, and you're not well-behaved. Good on you. Neither am I. So thank you for coming in, and Sylvia, thanks for inviting
me.
Yes,
I wanted to. Everybody knows Fabi, but not everybody knows all about Fabi. And last year, Taos had that promotional theme of remarkable women of Taos. Most of whom were featured were not homegrown. There were some that were homegrown. And there were many women, and there are many, many remarkable women in Taos who weren't part of that, that aren't captured sort of by this marketing theme. One of our most remarkable citizens is Fabi Romero. And one of the things about Fabi that's incredible that many people don't know is that she left after high school and took a bus to New York City and ended up living there for 20-some years. Was one of the people who started the first feminist bookstore on Manhattan. Wow. And got involved in the 1960s with the radical feminist movement in New York City, and was an activist in that. And I want her to talk about how she came to do that, how she got into it. Also, just about 2 weeks ago, or last week, these women had a reunion after so many years in New York City, to which Fabi attended, partly in the aftermath of the death of Shulamith Firestone, who was one of the important, well-known people in that movement. Many were very well-known and became very famous. Others were not so well-known and not so famous. But what the radical feminists did, as well as the more kind of mainstream feminists, although feminism was not mainstream then and maybe even not now, as well as the socialist feminists who came a little bit later, they changed our lives. The lives of women today are different because of the work that they did and the consciousness raising they did. And so I'd like to just say, Fabi, welcome. I'm so glad that you agreed to come to this. And let's start out by saying how you got to New York and how you got involved in these women and what was it like?
Well, I went to New York, as Sylvia just said, when I was 18. I was just a young woman trying to get ahead.
From Taos?
From San Cristobal.
San Cristobal to New York City.
From the hills of San Cristobal.
Big jump. And can I just jump in and ask, what in the world? That's a huge leap. How did you do it? Why? Who? Would you have a friend?
No, not at all. I grew up in San Cristobal where Jenny Vincent and Craig Vincent lived. I'm sure everybody knows about them. They had this incredible library where I used to go read a lot. And one day he told me he was one of the people who started the Maritime Union in New York and that he lived in New York. And I said, I was about 14, I guess 15. What was it like to live in New York, Craig? And he said, why don't you go there and find out?
Wow.
And it was like a light bulb went on in my head. I thought, oh, my God, I can go do that. And I did. Right. As soon as I'm sure all my senior classmates were sick and tired of me saying, well, as soon as we graduate, I'm going to New York. And I'm sure they thought I was full of
crazy,
it.
Crazy. Wow.
But I did.
Tell us more. Yes.
So, well, my first day in New York, actually, Sylvia, I took a bus to Kansas City where my sister was teaching. And they, from there, I was recruited to work for Eastern Airlines. and I was recruited because I spoke Spanish.
Wow.
And they had a route from New York City to San Juan, Puerto Rico, and they needed a person who could book reservations in Spanish. So they gave me a ticket to fly to New York, and I took a plane, landed in Newark, which I thought was New York, but I didn't. Well, obviously, it's not. It's New Jersey. But I asked, how do I get to New York? And this man said, well, you take that bus, and it takes you to 42nd Street and 7th Avenue, and there's a terminal there, and you'll be in New York. So I did. And I arrive with my little suitcase, and I look around for a place to sleep, and I see a hotel. And I go to check in at the hotel, and the man says, are you staying an hour or two?
So it was a real nice place.
Oh, well, but see, I didn't know about that, and I thought, how exciting. In New York, people don't sleep all night.
That's a great story. And now you are the one then that started the phrase, we're not in Kansas anymore. I can see that. It's not, forget the Wizard of Oz. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I had seen a movie in Taos called Executive Suite, but with Nina Folk, a very old actress. And she, in that movie, she told the hotel person to wake her up. And so I told the hotel person, wake me up. I have to go to my job interview. And he, of course, they didn't wake me up. It was a hotel of ill repute. And they didn't have
very well said.
Yeah. So I went to my job interview, and the woman who turned out to be my supervisor asked me if I had a place to sleep, and I said no. And she said, well, there's a young woman here who wants a roommate. Would you like to talk to her? And I said, sure. We ended up being roommates. She was a lesbian. Being from San Cristobal, I didn't know there was such a thing as lesbians.
Really?
Right. And I had never heard the word, didn't know there were homosexual people. So it was all, I thought, well, that's just another thing I need to learn about New York. People do different things, do things differently here. Mm-hmm. So my roommate was a lesbian. And I didn't learn till maybe weeks, months later, when another woman at my job said, you're living with a lesbian? That's an abomination in the eyes of the Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a sin. You can't live with her. And, well, by that time, it was too late. I liked the woman a lot.
Too late. We're fun. Come on. Let's face it. How great this is. Yeah.
Well, we used to share stories. She had problems with her dates, and I had problems with my dates. And I just thought it was all normal.
Well, we kind of do share that, yes.
And so that brings me to the reason I think we're at in this war that's still going on women, and it is seems to me to be raging hotter and harder than it ever has before. Mm-hmm. And I think that as feminists, we failed to understand the power of the cultural trends. And the cultural trends is what we learn, which becomes embedded in us. I didn't know that lesbianism was wrong. So obviously I didn't have that in my cultural trends, you know. There are other things in my cultural trends that I picked up, like there were two Anglo families in San Cristobal when I grew up, and they always hired cleaning women. I thought Anglos didn't know how to clean house. That they were kind of dirty people. So that was part of my cultural trends.
Except those poor ones. We were the house cleaners, too.
Right, but I did know people like you. The ones who lived there had money, and they hired cleaning women. So anyway, we hear now all these amazingly ignorant remarks about women that men make without any blush of shame that they've made such a stupid remark.
On even Fox News yesterday, where the reporter said to another woman reporter, shut up and know your place.
Exactly.
This is on, I hate to say it, but one of the most watched networks. And I am happy to say some of the female reporters at Fox News even took him on. But it's absolutely, it blew me back.
Well, like a man, the politician, I forget his name, who said that you couldn't get pregnant if you were raped and you didn't enjoy it.
Are we in a backlash? I mean,
of course.
I believe that too.
But I see, we did not understand the power of the cultural trends, and those men are in the cultural trends. And I know they know better, but they can't get out of it. Anyway, I thought too much.
No, keep going. I guess,
and Sylvia, jump in, yes.
How did you encounter the radical feminists? I mean, can you sort of paint a picture for us about your initial encounter with them and how you got involved? Because, I mean, back then, I mean, these women broke new ground, and there was a lot of radical thinking, and it was, I mean, how did you encounter that, and what did you think? How did you get involved?
Like I said, I was just a young woman trying to get ahead. By that time, I was married, and the Vietnam War was raging, and I was not involved with the Vietnam War until one night I saw a picture of a little girl running down the road with her back on the flames.
That famous photograph, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was horrified, and I said to my husband then, is that what's going on? And he said, of course. And so I found some anti-war groups, and I started protesting the war. And from there, we went on to protest civil rights. And then from there, I found the women. A lot of the women in the women's movement have been involved in anti-war and civil rights groups.
Wow.
And
yes.
So one night somebody handed me a flyer that said there was that Ann Kurt and Shirley Firestone were forming a CR group, a consciousness raising group, in the village. And did I want to attend? And mm-hmm. So I went to the meeting.
And
that was it. I was hooked.
What happened? I mean, what was like, you know, what was that first encounter like for you?
Well, these women were so exciting. They were so bright, and they were so determined and so intense. And they had a little flyer on the rules of the CR groups, which was women could talk without being judged, interrupted, questioned, or advised.
Right.
So you could just talk about your life. And what came from those CR groups is a commonality of women's lives, how no matter where, what class you came from, what racial group you came from, there was a stream that ran that was common for all women.
Right.
And you became an activist. And what were some of the activisms that you engaged in? And also, you started initiating conscious raising groups. Like you were saying the other day, you went to Queens for that and stuff.
And
talk a little bit about that.
And if I can just for a moment say, we throw these terms around like we all know what they mean. And I'd like for you to say in your own words, do you embrace the term activist? And if you do, what does it mean? And then and answer Sylvia's question. What is an activist to you?
An activist is somebody that sees how things are not working mm-hmm. or how things are mm-hmm. and then acts to correct the things that aren't.
Good definition. I like that. And so, more to that point.
So what were some of the activist activities you engaged in?
Well, New York State was the first state to legalize abortion. We lobbied hard. We demonstrated hard for that. We organized the picture I showed you, Nancy.
Yes, that's amazing. Do you want to describe it?
Yes, it's a group of women. We were given a permit to take over half of Fifth Avenue. Fifth Avenue is a one-way. All the avenues are one-way in New York. And they had told us we could take half of the avenue for a Women of the World Unite demonstration. Well, there were so many women, we didn't fit in half. Mm-hmm. So we took over the whole avenue. And that's the banner you see with all of us with our mouths open.
I know. It's amazing, though.
Yeah.
Your mouths are open because you have something to say.
Yeah, we were yelling. Yeah.
And
we were
Fabi,
yelling.
Right in the front lines there in this photograph.
Yeah, I'm holding, I'm helping to hold the banner.
I was trying to get us up and running, and I didn't get the time I wanted. Well, but I can find it if you want to continue.
Okay. We organized what we call the speak outs as radical feminists, we organized speak outs. We had a speak out on abortion. We had a speak out on motherhood. That's one I organized. I was head of the organization of that. We had a speak out on gay rights. For that one, we all wore banners that said, "I'm a dyke." Whether we were or not, we just wore banners that
Thank
said,
you for
I'm
doing that.
And that's because at one demonstration, they had yelled at us, "You dirty dykes, go home, you know, find a husband." The men would stand on the sidelines and yell obscenities at us. So we did that as a way to take back the word and to neutralize what they meant by it. And let's see, what we organized. a really interesting one on prostitution.
Is this you?
Yeah, that's me.
Oh, my goodness. There's a young, a younger, well, it's August 27th, 1970, and you are long, flowing hair. Dressed in pink. Yes, it is, but everyone is. It's a beautiful, by the way, photograph.
Isn't it a great photograph?
And I was just becoming the first female student body president of my junior high school, and I was fighting. I ran on the platform that girls deserve to wear pants, and I won, and we got to wear pants. Just wanted you to know, I was a little bit younger than you, but I was doing my own part. I was already a feminist. I thought we couldn't run, jump, and play.
But wasn't it interesting? We were not allowed to wear pants.
We were not allowed because it made us mobile.
Today, yeah,
couldn't young catch
women
us.
Today, find that my granddaughters don't believe me when I tell them.
No, they don't. I mean, and then when we did get the pants issue enacted, then they said, "This is my thing." It's funny about what Hillary Clinton is saying, but that was the home of the pantsuit. You had to have a matching. So for poor kids, it was tough. I mean, I had to go home and say to my mom, "I have to have a pantsuit," which meant your jacket had to match the pants, which was costly.
Uh-huh.
But that was the only way you could wear pants to school.
Well,
true story.
I'll tell you my story about my pantsuit.
Okay, don't worry. We have plenty of time.
We had a beautiful yellow linen pantsuit with a jacket down. And there's a Rockefeller Center. You all know it.
Yeah.
They skate in the winter, and in the summer, it's a restaurant.
Right.
My husband and I went down there to eat, and they told me I couldn't go in with my pants. So I just stepped out into the lobby.
What year is this?
This had to have been the early, mid-60s.
Listen up, my younger listeners, my younger female listeners. This is in, you know, 1960s in New York City. Our own Fabi Romero turned away from a restaurant because she has pants on. Why? I would have just taken them off.
And I did. Says, that's exactly what I did.
Oh, Fabi.
And my jacket was long enough it covered. What was essentially covered. And I walked back up to
They thought you were wearing a mini skirt.
I was wearing a mini skirt.
So that was more appropriate because they could see your legs and you didn't have pants on like a man.
You know who broke the taboo of pants was Jackie Kennedy.
Was she the first? I think of Katharine Hepburn. She made it fashionable.
In the movies.
Yes.
But you still were not allowed to wear pants in public. But Jackie Kennedy started wearing pants to restaurants and wherever she wished, and then we were allowed to do it.
Go Jackie.
Yes.
That's an incredible story. And we're doing this salon style. So Sylvia Rodriguez, who joins us, thank you so much. I know you all have been friends for a long time. And this is such a treat. If I may just ask you, because this is such a day, as a member of the LGBTQ community, tomorrow's ruling, I have to tell you, I'm teary, I'm edgy. I know I have to make peace with whichever way this goes. We're not done. If it goes one way, we celebrate. If it goes another, but this is so intricately tied.
Oh, it is.
Do you think? Would you mind?
And
I know you as a member of the LGBT community, Sylvia. You must. I don't know. I'll ask you. But you're always such a cool cat. I can't tell. But
tell what?
I don't know. I've got my emotions. I'm like crying, and I'm worked up.
What I want to do in this session is to there wouldn't have been Stonewall. There wouldn't have been the LGBT movement, which is happening. Had the radical feminists and the feminists not laid the foundation for it.
And we
because
thank
the
you.
Because the radical feminists were the ones who saw the gender divide in sexual politics is the core of all oppression. Mm-hmm. And different feminists had different analyses. The socialists came in and say, well, what about class and race? And they shot down, you know, like the more,
right.
None of it was conventional. But the courage and the vision that these women had, and also the internal issues and the conflicts that they had, I think are really instructive for us today. So I want you to talk a little bit about that. And also about this reunion and how you groundbreakers, you pioneers, came together and looked back at what had happened and what's happening now. I know it's a lot of questions, but sort of that's really
and then
the
mine
ground
too,
I want you to
how
cover.
It ties into what we're actually seeing in current events today. And you began this series with a where you believe in a swing pendulum backlash period. So all of that, no pressure. We'll go over our time. We've got plenty. I want you here, and I want you to take your time.
And I just want to throw in that Fabi took her granddaughters to this reunion.
Yes, wow. I did, my 11 and 12-year-old granddaughters.
What a grandma they have.
Well, I took them to Rockefeller Center and told them the story of the pantsuit, and they did not believe me.
And you want to give their first names?
Yes, Camille is 12, and Erica is 11.
Gosh, and they didn't believe you?
No. They didn't believe me.
Wow. And I, too, I mean, I really bow to you and all of the women and a few good men who stood beside us. You did are exactly right. We would not even be having this conversation had it not been laid out
for all those women
by our feminists, which we don't hear a lot of. So we threw out a lot of things at you, but shoot.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the reunion, there were only 12 of us. Because a lot have died, a lot have moved away. But we mostly talked about how the women today have no idea what it was like. You know, they don't know about the hangar abortions where women bled to death. They don't know about all the closeted lesbians who committed suicide. I had a friend who committed suicide. They don't know about any of that. To them, they take so much for granted. And what worried us at this reunion was that they take it so much for granted that they're going to lose it, that if they don't become more aware and more aggressive and more demanding, they're going to lose it. They're going to lose the right to abortion, which will be just criminal.
Already in the works.
Yeah.
We've already seen laws passed, and I think that you're exactly right. This education by having you on, and I really believe you were the generation directly whose shoulders I stood on. I was just behind you. I mean, abortion was legal, but we were still fighting for pants and mm-hmm. we were being discriminated against, and we still are. But I mean, blatantly in the workforce. I mean, if a guy grabbed your ass, you didn't dare say a word because there was zero, none, no protection. You would be out in the street without a job and no one would hire you.
But those days are not over.
No, they're not.
Over.
But we do at least have some laws on the books.
Yeah, there's a concept of sexual harassment now.
At least yes, good point.
And it's so hard to swallow. And even in academia, there is resentment of that. And it's only in the last 10 or 15 years that the University of New Mexico has implemented those guidelines.
Amazing.
Because one of the perks of academia for male professors was, you know, having shots at the undergrads or the graduate students. Very common practice. It's pervasive. But sort of the vision and the courage of those days, and also I think that the conflicts over it, I think are important to talk about. And I think you mentioned the other day when we were talking how someone had read Shulamith Firestone recently and said, well, that ho-hum. But back then, Shulamith Firestone was not ho-hum.
Oh, no.
And it's a measure of the progress that has been made that now some of those things are taken for granted.
Right. But people like Shulamith Firestone, who wrote The Dialectic of Sex.
Yes.
And Kate Millett, Sexual Politics.
She came to College of Marin when I was at school there.
She was a professor at Barnard when I was there.
Yeah.
And these, get their books, you guys, Kate Millett. And did you work with Gloria Steinem?
No. Gloria Steinem was another level. She was more the glamour PR person who actually served a role. She brought our ideas and our vision into the popular media.
Like the mainstream media.
Right, the mainstream media.
Gotcha. Who were then do you think the core, maybe the names? I just like to call out names of those women who may not have gotten the Gloria Steinem recognition, but that were there. Fabi Romero.
There was one, Andrea Dworkin. Have you read her books?
Yes.
Woman Hating, yes. She was a big visitor in our bookstore because we sold her books. Let's see, Adrienne Rich.
Oh, yes.
Susan Griffin.
I hadn't thought of Susan Griffin, yeah.
You haven't? She wrote one of my favorite poems. It's called I Like to Think of Harriet Tubman. I can't recite it verbatim.
We'll get it before you go away.
Yeah, and she says, when those men in Washington decide that children should only eat every other day, you know, when they cut their funding, I like to think of Harriet Tubman with her gun.
I do know this poem.
Yes, I used to love
absolutely
that poem.
Do. I even, and you know what? Yeah, keep talking.
And she was, Susan Griffin was such a gentle, gentle person. You know, she used to come into the bookstore a lot. And every time I saw her, I think of that Harriet Tubman with her gun.
So I'm putting you on the list. Fabi Romero, Andrea Dworkin. Audrey and Rich, Susan Griffin.
Yeah. Audre Lorde, another great poet.
Audre Lorde.
Yeah. Sharon Olds, who just got the Pulitzer for poetry. Mm-hmm. She used to organize poetry readings in our bookstore. Very gentle, genteel woman. I liked her. Yeah. Olga Brumas, Entesaki Shange, who wrote for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough.
Oh, my gosh. I haven't heard that name in forever. Olga, spell that for
Olga Brumas.
B-R-U-M-A-S. Thank you.
She was a Greek poet.
I think I'm going to list these on my Facebook page, by the way, for those of you who are my friends, so that you can look them up, revisit them, or for the first time be introduced to them. We have now Taos Pride or Young. We don't really have women's bookstores. I think there's one left in the country.
Hardly any bookstores at all left.
Right. Yeah. But they disappeared, which I think is a very sad thing. I think there are a lot of younger women who think we don't need these. They're redundant. We can do anything we want. But as you said, and I wanted you to expand on that, while we're doing that, you know, there are forces working to erode these rights, right, not only for us, but we're all connected to me. If you just see what the Supreme Court did today for people of color, they've just taken away the Voting Act. I keep forgetting the name of it, the university.
Sexual harassment code?
No, the one of the admissions.
Oh, yes.
What is that
affirmative
called?
Affirmative action.
Thank you. Affirmative action. I don't know why I keep slipping. They've done away with it.
Yeah. Well, when you think of the rapes in the military.
We just did a show on that with Carol Miller yesterday.
It is so outrageous. It is like outrageous, unbelievable and outrageous. Like, how is that possible that it's happening? And it's because in the New York Radical Feminists' main theory was, or their main position was, that all men benefited from sexism and from the oppression of women, even nice men. They all benefit from
it. And they still do.
And that we need to examine each and every one of those ways they benefit and all the institutions that help them benefit. And that's what made, I think, New York Radical Feminists different from so many of the other groups.
Right. I think it's important to say something about consciousness raising as a method.
It was a method that the feminists borrowed from Mao Zedong.
Well, also from Paulo Freire, who called it something else.
Yeah, right. He called it something else.
What did he call it? Do you want to say? Was it in Spanish?
In the pedagogy of the oppressed.
Yeah, right. Conscientización, right?
Yeah.
Consciousness raising.
Consciousness
people talking
raising.
About okay. their own situation. Yeah.
So I love the question. So yes, what about that?
Well, the radical feminists began by organizing small groups of like 12 women. Mm-hmm. And in that group, you could talk. And that's when I said, in that talk, you find the commonality. And there were leaderless groups. Nobody headed them. One person would organize them. Like, I would call somebody in Queens that I knew and say, could you invite all your friends to your house on this night and we'll come and talk to them about CR, consciousness raising? And she would, and we'd show up, a couple of us would show up, and we'd explain to them the purpose of consciousness raising and how it was done. And then that group would go on its own. And in times of like speak outs, like on prostitution or abortion or rape or motherhood, then all those groups would come together, and there were thousands of women in those groups, thousands. Wow. And many of those women, their lives were so radically changed by those groups. I saw a woman break down and cry and say, I thought I was the only one who felt that way. Or I thought I was the only one that these things happened to. And I thought it was all my fault. And in those CR groups, they found that it wasn't them, that it's sexism and the oppression that put them in those positions and created that kind of situation for them. And so it was very, it was enlightening for women and empowering. It empowered women to began to think that they deserved better.
And as a result of your work, by the time I hit College of Marin, we had women's studies courses. They were the, and again, well, College of Marin is a pretty liberal place to be, but there was some resentment. I mean, that's not a real class. What are you all doing? I mean, there was a mm-hmm. great deal of suspicion and undermining of what we were actually doing. But being able to speak, very important, and be heard.
Yeah, I think it's important. These new, which are no longer new so much anymore, these new sort of academic areas, women's studies, black studies, Chicano studies, even environmental studies, new women's history, all of these innovative programs that encountered so much resistance in the universities that broke new ground in scholarship had their roots in activism.
Uh-huh.
I mean, feminism starts, I mean, the second wave of feminism, it was called, with Friedan's book. The early ones were the ones who helped women get the vote. But their books, when I read Kate Millett's book, and I was at college where she was a teacher, I had no idea. It blew my mind.
Right. What was the book that blew your mind?
Sexual Politics,
yes.
Which is a literary criticism book. And there she was in her trench coat with, you know, Catherine Stimson, and I didn't know what was going on. And, you know, and there she was meeting downtown with, you know, with Fabi, who I wouldn't know for another 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. Women's studies has activist roots. What's happened with women's studies, as what happens in academic, is that it became increasingly theoretical and divorced from community activism.
Yeah.
But it had its roots in that.
And what happens when we have that split? Obviously, it becomes less effective, but maybe because you're talking about us slipping back, and I mm-hmm. think this, you might be onto something. That split, we've lost the connection of these two things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think whenever you remove something into academia, into theory, you remove it from the rest of us.
Yeah.
Because it's another world, and it no longer applies to your everyday life. It becomes removed. On the other hand, some great books came out of, you know, I'm thinking of Audrey Rich's A Woman Born, mm-hmm. which is a book on motherhood.
That's right.
Jane Lazar's The Mother Knot, another book, because these are institutions, motherhood, which nobody ever, everybody thought it's a holy state to be in, you know, mother, being a mother. And yet, when you examine the institutions of motherhood, you see how really against mothers they are.
And this is, again, and if I may bring it to the current, I have a partner who's 18 years younger than I am, and I have a real trouble with the word wife. As a feminist in the 70s, mm-hmm. I looked at my mom and I thought, I didn't even know what I was yet, but I thought, I am not doing that. That thing there, I do not want wife. Somebody 18 years younger than me embraces the term. Mm-hmm. It's empowering to her. And we have a generational divide on what that means. And for another generation, that's not, and maybe there are people my age that don't have that feeling about it. I have a friend who's straight, who embraces the term. But for me, to look at a 50s mother mm-hmm. didn't look like anything I ever wanted a part of. So I'm keep trying to figure out, if I do get married, do I call myself a knife? What am I? I'm Nancy and I'm married. I'm a knife. I'm partner. Sounds like we're in business. I mean, what the heck am I going to be? Do you all know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I was married for 18 years, and never once did I introduce the man I was married to as my husband. It was just a matter of principle.
And you asked to be introduced, I'm sure, by your name.
Right.
That's what I said. And she says to me, what's wrong? I said, I'm Nancy. Damn it. I'm Gumby. Damn it. You know, it's like, and do you have a problem?
Well, I think part of what's happened, of course, is that back in the 60s and the early 70s, our generation thought the world was on the verge of a huge revolution. And I don't think we anticipated this incredible swing to the right that we're still suffering from, where the Republican right has been chipping away, and conservatives have been chipping away at the gains that we've made, but also with the language. I mean, today, young women often shy away from the term feminism. You see also in so many cultural areas, you know, sort of the radical feminists, many burnt bras, stopped wearing makeup. There was a whole period in the 70s where androgynous clothing was sort of in. But you see now, I mean, the clothing styles are increasingly gender divided. I mean, women's clothes have gotten much more sort of precious and cutesy than they used to be. And so there's a chipping away at the institutions and the laws, but there's also this insidious cultural process that's going on. And so I think younger women think somehow that the gains of the 60s and 70s can be assumed and taken for granted. I think they don't realize the struggle, the political and the social and the psychological struggle it took women to get to those critiques of our fundamental institutions. So I think there is a divide, and I think that we're seeing is that we can lose this ground. They're working on losing this ground.
We are losing this ground. It's happening today.
Right, as we speak.
And we don't have any women like Florence Kennedy, one of the first black lawyers, I think, in New York State. She was a labor law lawyer. She was in your face. She didn't apologize for what she knew was right. And the dialogue I hear now is, it's almost apologetic. Like when people talk about women's right to abortion, they say, well, what if you've been raped or incest or it's a deformed child or for your health? No, it should be, if I don't want to have a baby, I have the right to abortion. Mm-hmm. And women are shying away from stating that bluntly because they don't want to offend.
And so we're more apologetic. Yeah. And then we have, the term lipstick lesbian. When I came out, you were butch or you were femme. And I was 19. And I was like, well, your collar's up or it's down? It's like, well, I had one up and one down. I don't know. And then it's okay, so you're a soft butch. It's like, well, I don't really know if I want to do all that. And I don't know what you think about that, but I think
it's interesting. I think the L word was an interesting program in many ways.
Absolutely.
And what that showed was, of course, a glamour, a lesbian lifestyle that was glamorous beyond imagination.
Right,
anything
like,
I was knew about in Los Angeles when I lived there. But I think that some of these younger women would say, seizing the lipstick and the glamour as a thing of power rather than subordination. I mean, I think there has been a kind of repurposing of some of these things that maybe our generation doesn't quite get.
Like it's their choice rather than
conforming. Yeah, it's that there's choice and that,
conforming.
You can do the femme glamour and still be empowered. So I think one of the questions I'd like to say, who are you out there in Radio Land, young women? Women who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s. Now everybody looks young to me now that I'm 65. But it's like, where is your feminism? What's going on out there? And do you know that we could lose what we've gained? And, it's like, we sort of see that a lot has been lost, but it's like, we need also to hear from these younger women what they're doing, how they see things. And we need to keep carrying on the torch.
A good question. I will open the lines. We're running over, and I don't care. I'm non-apologetic for it. The men who follow me until Randy Rhodes can just, Ed Schultz, stand by. No, they're all great liberals. But 758-5868, 758-5868, if you want to comment on what you're hearing. And I think these stories, you notice I'm rolling, and this will be entered in next year's NMBA Awards, I can assure you. This is a slice of history that, I mean, I'm going through my own family history now, and I'm telling you, we're one generation away from losing, and I'm having to actually hire people to investigate my heritage. And so I say to everyone out there, sit down with your grandmas, your great-grandmas, if you're lucky enough to have them around, and start recording or doing something, because it'll be gone. And your story is really important to me.
Somebody ought to be taking Fabi's oral history.
Well, we are. It's going on right now. Fabi, other things you would like young women to know about your time relative to what we're seeing now, and what if you could say to a young feminist who might not even feel like, I don't even have a place to go. There's not a bookstore. We don't meet that way. The term doesn't even get, people say, oh, we don't even need it anymore. Well, I think that's nonsense, as you pointed out so clearly. We're losing ground. So, but what you say to them?
I think what I would say to them is that it's all about choice. You choose your life. You don't let the culture dictate to you what your life should be. I had decided when I was about 12 that I would never have children because I felt that I didn't have a choice, mm-hmm. that I was supposed to have children, that that was what was meant for me. And so I told my sisters, I'm never going to have any babies. Mm-hmm. Never.
I said that when I was about 4. My mother was like, what?
Yeah. Well, then in the feminist movement, I understood choice, and I decided to have a baby. So I went, when I realized that I didn't really have a choice, I wasn't reacting anymore. I was choosing.
Right. It was your and there are now a lot of course, same-sex couples who are choosing to have them biologically or adopt, mm-hmm. And then they divorce, and there's alimony. And I mean, we're getting all the same rights or want as straight people in that sense, yeah.
So I guess what I would say to young women is look around you, look at the things that impact your life, and examine them. And don't think for one moment that you're alone in that. That whatever is happening to you, whatever impacts you, is impacting thousands, tens of thousands of other young women like you. And you should know that.
Can I just say, back to consciousness raising as a method, because you don't, if you're in isolation, you don't necessarily know. And you were saying the ways in which the culture makes us think things are natural. It's like we need to constantly be vigilant about that because it's unconscious and it's taken for granted and it's usually billed as nature or God's will. And I think that there consciousness.
She's making air quotes, by the way.
Right. Consciousness raising is not obsolete. I mean, it can apply to environmentalism, it can apply to racism, it can apply to kind of the sort of issues you've been talking about. Should communities accede to corporations dictating their future and their environment? It's like when people get together to talk about their situation and to analyze it and to give each other feedback, that is a powerful method that Freire, that Mao, that the feminists did and that we can continue to do today. And it's a form of self-education and consciousness raising. And it's something I mean, we cannot imagine alternatives alone. We need other people together, pooling. And even the Esekia movement does this. And I think it's a really powerful tool. And it's not out of style.
And I want to say it's very, very simple. I want to get back to the way you did it. We're trying. This is what everybody says. Forget the president. I mean, you may love him, you may not. But you can call him and that's great. But the way change is going to happen is exactly what you talked about. I called another woman and in Queens and said, it'll be at my house tonight. We have to get back to gathering in our own communities, in our homes, in coffee houses, in parks, to talk to each other. I mean, that's powerful stuff. Today, I've asked people to gather at noon at Walmart's parking lot, peacefully, please, as the mayor and Dan Baroni ask this salesperson to not sell fireworks. We have no law because our lawmakers sold out to the lobbyists, taking away our local jurisdiction as they are doing with fracking in Pennsylvania. And thank God Las Vegas has taken steps, but we are very vulnerable in northern New Mexico. That is exactly what they want to do, is to take that right away so that Cuesta, San Cristobal, and Taos cannot say, as a community, we're a little worried about fracking. Nope, can't do that. The state says, you no longer have local jurisdiction. These are not disconnected. Shall we take a call? I think we should. What do you think? Let's do it. Good morning. You're on the air with Fabi Romero, Silvio Rodriguez, and, of course, me, Nancy. Hi. Who have I got here?
This is Rena Rosequist, and what a treat to hear you all.
Thank you, Rena.
Can't let you get off the air without telling you what a pleasure it was to listen to such heartfelt conversation. It leads to the best radio imaginable. And I just want Fabi to know that there, those of us her age and maybe even older, who have never forgotten what a struggle it was to get to where we are today. Everything from labor unions, everything we learned, the older people are still carrying with them, and we really do have to really talk more about how you keep the revolution going.
And Rena, as a, I've known you for a long time. I think you are the generation that perhaps Fabby stood on the shoulders of. Tell us, me or our listeners, I'd love to hear what you think is our greatest threat right now, and what we need to do.
Our greatest threat, as far as I'm concerned, is the eroding of the Constitution. That's an overall concern. The Supreme Court is far more powerful than the Senate or the House of Representatives. After all, it was 9 people who chose George Bush to be our president. And never take your eyes off the Supreme Court. If Obama gets to appoint 2 more people to the Supreme Court, it can change the course of our country. If he doesn't, it will change in a very vastly awful way. So people who say, I don't like politics, you know, they're all the same, don't realize they're talking about their own lives, and the only people who are going to protect their rights, really, in the end, are themselves. However, I had an older aunt who said, well, she really liked what women were doing. But sometimes, she's from the South, and she used Southern terminology, like she'd say, women act so ugly. Do they have to act so ugly? And I said, you know what? Because they act ugly, you don't have to. They're fighting this for you. Get behind them. And it was the first time that she kind of understood that it was, you know, what everybody else was doing, she should have a part in, too, and it really changed her. Anyway, thank you all for the wonderful stories, Fabby. Great to hear your New York stories, and has the making of a great book.
Wow, anyway, Rena, you're one of our living legends and treasures, and thank you so much for your participation on this show and for being who you are. I appreciate it so
thank
much.
Thank you, Rena.
Well,
thank
you,
Rena.
You, and I love hearing Sylvia regularly. She always brings something new to the table, and the history of this place, which is so important. Don't ever forget your history.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Rena, great comments today, and so many women out there. And again, I think really a little bit older than you. Generationally, we've got this. Haven't heard from any young women, 758-5868, younger, in your maybe 20s or 30s. I'd love your take. Does feminism have any meaning to you today? It certainly does to me. I identify as a feminist first. And I notice the generation before me very much more will sometimes say, well, I identify more with the LGBT community, or I am a Democrat, or I'm with the Green. I'm a feminist for me. Mm-hmm. That was my orientation. It still is.
Yeah, I think right now we're operating the world in a truly male consciousness. And it seems to me that the female consciousness has moved to the background. And I think that's why so much of what's going on is going on. You know, the rape in the rapes in the military, the eroding of abortion rights, the eroding of women's rights to their own bodies. It's very male consciousness.
Yes, of course, they still rule the world. I mean, they're still the masters of the universe that are running the world and ruining it, you know, clearly. Testosterone poisoning is run amok on the planet. But I think also our situation when we came to consciousness in the 60s and 70s was so different. The historical moment was so completely different that the possibilities opened up. We're at a different point right now, and I often think how terrifying it would be to be a young person today when there isn't that sense that, okay, the revolution is at hand. I mean, we thought it was. We were wrong, but it gave us so much anima and hope. And today, young people are facing... It's like almost hard to know where's the enemy? Who's the enemy? You know, it's like
do we
thought
one?
We knew.
Do we need one?
We need something to, I think, you can't address it all. I mean, you say you're a feminist. Well, I say, well, one, there have been advances in thinking. I mean, the feminist thinkers have really covered some ground in the analysis of sexual politics and gender. But another thing is like what they call intersecting oppressions. I mean, you know, you don't want to have to choose between being a feminist and being a Chicana, or being a lesbian and being a Black woman, or being a poor person, or being an environmentalist. It's like everybody sort of has to pick their front. And I think one of the things you learn when you get older is you pick your battles. So it's like, we were naive. I mean, there was the Vietnam War. Before that, there was civil rights, which was, you know, really what kicked it all off. And then there were the local, you know, the land grant movement here in New Mexico. So it's like, you can't address them all at once. And I think the Occupy movement is a really interesting thing, because these young people, and they were not just young people, but of all ages, were really trying to think and act outside the box. Mm-hmm. And people dismiss it because, oh, they didn't have a program, they didn't have a leader. But I think they chose that. And I think they're looking for a different model. And I think we do need a different model. And one of the points that Rena made, using different words, is that change isn't going to come from above. It's going to come from below. You know, and we are, in some sense, below. I mean, each of us has privilege that we're blind to. But all of us, each of us, suffers some form of oppression. And more of us are sort of, you know, in the 99%. And so it's like this sense that there is something you can do, but it's like you may have to pick your battle, and you can't address it all at once.
True. Mm-hmm. I like what you're saying, yeah. And to really focus in, I call it singleness of purpose, because it can be overwhelming.
But they're all related.
Absolutely.
They're all interconnected.
From the fireworks to the decision from the Supreme Court mm-hmm. on gay marriage, these are not disconnected. To turning corporations into people, I think that will go down in history as one of the largest, greatest destroyers of democracy, maybe the last vestige of democracy.
The most ecocidal invasive species on the planet is the corporation.
And it now is a person. But it, oh, right. But by the way, P.S. has no responsibilities.
Right.
How does, I mean, I really think we made a fatal error. And it's not too late, because there are people like us and Rena and listening in that we don't even know about that are saying, oh no, I'm having a house party next week, and my issue is water, LGBT rights, you fill in the blank, lobbyist money. We can pick an issue, and mm-hmm. I believe we will make a difference. We are. Fabi, closing thoughts?
No, I think Sylvia has stated it really brilliantly, and so have you, Nancy. And we are here now, and this is where we have to act from.
Well, I hope we can get you back. There are so many. This has just been such a treat for me. I feel like these are the days where I think I have the best job in the world, being able to hear pieces of your story, but there's so much more. And
you know something I've been meaning to tell you, Nancy? I really appreciate you having two people on, Phyllis Bennis and Bob Jensen. They are the two people I can never disagree with. Anything they have ever said, I have agreed with.
I will pass that on. Bob will make a joke about it, and they will both appreciate it. And so I'll pass it on to them.
But thank you for having them.
And any other guests that you, Sylvia, you've been great about that. You're a gem.
Well, of course, Sylvia, too. But
she is. She gets more compliments. And you guys make the show. And I got to tell you another thing that's an issue of mine. Local radio. We are losing it. And this mm-hmm. talk about communication has become so homogenized. And I know there are people who will say, I'm a mouthpiece for the mayor. I think you all know I've been fired about 5 times from radio for taking on my immediate boss. I'm not. And the idea that we have lines open, no screeners, your ability to call this show and talk about anything within legal limits, i.e. you can't use dirty words or use slanderous statements, you're on my show. This is a dying venue. Mm-hmm. And if you have any money in your couch cushions, buy a signal. Get a radio station. Get a community radio station. Get a television outlet. Certainly social media is great. But when everything went down, we were still on. So I do this, and I think you both know that it's not for the money. I mean, more money as a waitress. I love what I do, and I also think this is my cause. And if we lose these outlets, we will be less effective in being able to make community.
Absolutely. Radio, community radio is an essential component. I mean, it's been very important in Latin America. It's very important in grassroots mobilizations. So you're right. And there's, I think the audience for radio is greater than for the other media, which I think is a stunning.
It is number one in small markets, especially.
And so Robin, if you're out there, go Robin, go Cultural Energy.
Go Cultural Energy.
He's got himself a radio station and does beautiful work on cultural energy. And you're absolutely right about radio. It's our medium.
Thank you for supporting it. Fabi Romero, come back and see me, and I love when you call. And Sylvia Rodriguez, you are a gem. She's a professor of anthropology emeritus, and Fabi's done so many things, had so many incarnations, but you are the...
Many.
You are the...
Fabi's a firebrand.
She is the definition for me of an activist, whether you're being quiet or whether you're calling the show or whether you're out there with a sign, and you've done it all. So thank you so much. Little
thank
piece
you,
I love your photograph. Appreciate it. I got to experience this today. I know we ran over, and I'm glad of it. A couple of things I want to announce before we go. 1340 KVOT Taos. We are your community, connective, and yes, progressive talk radio station. We are the voice of the world, and indeed we're located in Taos. You can catch us online at www.1340kvot.com. I will be posting this interview soon. I've got some things to cover, but by this afternoon it should be up, so send your friends there. They can listen. And that, the way you do that is to become a fan of mine. You have to be on Facebook. In that search box, you put Breakfast with Nancy and like it, and you're in. We don't have any, bodyguards keeping anybody out of there. Everybody can be a fan. So find this interview there.